House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Monday, February 8th, 2016. And the first item on the agenda is House Bill 4128.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. This is House Bill 4128. It is brought to us today by Representative Vega Peterson. There is a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact. This bill addresses a particular type of fraud related to immigration consultants or notarios. Some individuals represent themselves as immigration consultants or notaries and deceive individuals into thinking they are qualified to give legal advice. In Oregon, an immigration consultant must be a member of the Oregon State Bar. This deception results in serious harm, including the filing of frivolous claims and monetary losses. House Bill 4128 does several things. It renames theft by extortion to simply extortion and expands that crime to include compelling a person to refrain from reporting unlawful conduct to law enforcement and adds reporting of immigration status as one of the means of inducing or compelling a victim of extortion. It also expands the crime of obstructing government or judicial administration to include acting as an immigration consultant or a notary without authorization and with the intent to defraud. Finally, House Bill 4128 adds qualification requirements for becoming a notary public and authorizes the Secretary of State to deny, revoke, suspend, or impose conditions on a notary public who has been convicted of impersonating a notary public, obstructing governmental or judicial administration, or engaging in the unlawful practice of law, or if a court has found that the person practiced law without a license, or a court has found that the person engaged in an unlawful trade practice, or has entered into an assurance of voluntary compliance for purporting to be an immigration consultant without being a member of the Oregon State Bar. There are no amendments.
Hey, thank you, Representative Vega Peterson. Representative Gallegos, please.
Chair Barker, actually, it's hard to see you. You're backlit. I don't think that's a halo, but Chair Barker, Vice Chair Leininger, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joe Gallegos, and I am State Representative for House District 30, which is North Hillsboro, North Plains, Aloha, a couple of houses in Beaverton. Thank you for this opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 4128. Last session, the legislature passed House Bill 3525, co-chiefed, sponsored by myself and Representative Vega Peterson, which established the Notario Fraud Task Force. This task force dealt with the issue of unlawful immigration consultants, known as notarios, and sought to find ways to amend the current status to give law enforcement tools to adequately combat the problem. So what are we talking about in terms of notarial fraud? Under ORS 9.280, only lawyers and federally authorized representatives may provide advice on immigration issues. Notarios are regulated by the, notaries are regulated by the Secretary of State's Corporate Division and are only authorized to witness the signing of documents and administered oaths. Yet a problem has arisen in many immigrant communities. When individuals obtain a notario, a notary license, and advertise themselves as a notario, a figure similar to an attorney in many Latin American countries. Through the legislature previously prohibited, the use of the terms a notario or notario público by anyone but an immigrant immigration attorney, unlawful notarios have been active across the state. Notarios typically claim they can do the work of an immigration or tax attorney, and they prey on immigrant communities and those who are unfamiliar with the U.S. legal system. They charge the victims thousands of dollars for immigration assistance they do not have a license, expertise, or training to provide. Additionally, notarios regularly re-victimize those they have already taken advantage of by threatening them with harm if they seek help. There have been reports of notarios demanding additional money, holding important legal documents as ransom, or threatening to report clients or family members to the authorities. So how was this issue brought to the legislature? In the fall of 2014, the Oregon State Bar hosted a conference on the issue. It became clear that this statewide issue and that a new approach was needed to give law enforcement the necessary tools to combat notarial fraud. Dick Ginsburg, an immigration lawyer and long-term community advocate, called an informal work group that began discussing on possible legislation. Dick died actually a year ago, March 1st, 2015. So this in many ways is a legacy of Mr. Ginsburg's. What work has been done since the 2015 session based on the results of the informal work group, Representative Vega Peterson and I submitted House Bill 3525, which would have amended the Oregon ORS 162.235, the governmental or judicial administration obstruction statute. The original proposed changes would have added language that made it a crime to intentionally act or obstruct, impair, or hinder any person from reporting notarial fraud to law enforcement or a judge by instilling a fear that someone would harm the victim if report was made. It became clear that we needed to explore other options for combating this problem, and we amended House Bill 3525 to become a task force. Representative Vega Peterson will follow with additional information on the task force makeup, process, recommendations, and the compromise of House Bill 4128. And also, if there are any difficult questions, she will answer them for you.
Thank you. Thank you, Rep. Gallegos. Thank you, Chair Barker and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jessica Vega Peterson. I am the state representative from House District 47 in East Portland. Thanks again for the opportunity to bring this bill before you. As Rep. Gallegos said, House Bill 4128 is the result of the task force that this committee heard last year in House Bill 3525. And I have to say that, first of all, I just want to thank everybody on the task force to coming together to work on this issue. This task force was co-chaired by myself and Senator Gelser, and I wanted to thank everyone individually because I think people came together in the spirit of really trying to find, recognizing that notarial fraud, immigration consultant fraud was a big problem and that we needed to do something. It was just a matter of getting the right people in the room to figure out what that something was. So briefly, I just wanted to say that the Notarial Fraud Task Force was made up of Amber Hollister, representing the Oregon State Bar, John Mirandis, representing immigration attorneys, Judith Parker, representing the Oregon Advocacy Commission's office, Aaron Knott, representing the Department of Justice, Stephanie Engelsman, representing the Oregon Criminal Defense Attorneys, John Harrelson, representing Oregon District Attorneys, Bonnie Ellen Saylor, representing Advocates for Low-Wage Workers, Keith Bickford from the Multnomah County Detective Office, Shanpon Sinlapasai, representing an advocacy group for immigrants and refugees, and also Peter Threckel from the Secretary of State's Corporate Division. So all of these people came together three times in August and September to take a look at the issue and to talk about the best ways of approaching it. What we did is we reviewed what the current statute said, and we explored amendments that might be possible in the criminal and civil regulatory statutes. So we talked about how could we better give law enforcement and also the Secretary of State's office better tools to fight notarial fraud. And as a result of those discussions, we came up with House Bill 4128, which really focuses on three things. And Whitney did a wonderful job of explaining, going into detail on those three areas. But really, they mainly focus on changes to the statutes dealing with theft by extortion, regulation of notaries by the Secretary of State's office, and looking at obstruction of justice. So we have this three-pronged approach that is in the bill before you. We also continue to recommend that there be education, ongoing education of both law enforcement officers and also of members of the community who are most impacted by notarial fraud to really get at the heart of this issue in addition to the statutory changes that we're advocating for. So one of the things that I wanted to talk about, we talked a lot about the bill, and there will be some folks coming up in the next panel who will go into these three separate areas in more detail, and you're welcome to ask the technical questions to that group. I don't have the pleasure of being a lawyer, but what I will tell you is that In June of this year, the Supreme Court will be having a decision on President Obama's immigration executive action. And whatever the result of this of that decision is, what the immigration law community feels will happen is that there is going to be an increase in the number of people who are looking for help with their immigration status, whether it's upheld or whether it's defeated, because they're going to need some solutions either to help with the new process in place or to figure out what their best solution is. And what this means is that there's going to be more opportunity for notario consultant fraud to happen as more people are looking for help with this and putting more people in a vulnerable position. So I'm really glad that we have the opportunity to take a look at this bill this session and act on it this session in the hopes that we can put some things in place that will help those people who are working on this issue. I am happy to answer any questions that you have. And thanks again for looking at this bill.
You, any questions? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, Peter Strelkel, Aaron Knott, and John Harrelson, please. And Champon Sinalopsi, you can come, we'll get a chair, another chair, and you can come on up with it.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Attorney General in the Oregon Department of Justice here in support of House Bill 4128. As mentioned previously, I was a member of this task force, and my involvement on it, I think, was in large part because this conduct is, and this bill does a few different things. I was most involved with the changes to the extortion statute. It's fundamentally about making a threat, and when you make a threat, how that threat is treated. And that, of course, is a restriction on speech that has to be made very carefully under the Oregon Constitution. So very early in this process, I engaged and others engaged with the Office of Legislative Counsel, and a lot of the changes that we discovered we had to make into the extortion statute were just sort of overdue revisions for constitutional purposes. To give you an obvious example, presently, extortion happens if you threaten to cause physical injury or cause damage to property. We changed that to unlawfully. I can absolutely beat up my own car if I feel like it. That's one of the joys of property ownership. That's completely lawful. So that's an example of the kind of non-substantive change we had to make here. The more substantive changes were all about recognizing that being threatened with, in essence, with deportation is a very powerful and very hurtful thing. And in fact, it's a criminal thing in a lot of contexts. It sets you up for an incredible amount of abuse, and it makes it very hard to resort to the usual means of going to law enforcement. And so this bill takes a big step forward in providing that protection. You can't be extorted on the basis of being here unlawfully or for your immigration status. Now, actually codifying that, you'll notice we've gone from theft by extortion to extortion, and that's because we've recognized that you can be extorted in a number of different ways that don't necessarily have to do with the transfer of property. This plays out a few different ways, one of which is we've inserted the word services into this statute. You can be compelled to deliver something that isn't a material good but is still of benefit. To give sort of an easy example, if you're a mechanic and you're being threatened, you know, fix up my truck or I'm going to turn you in. Well, that's not property. It's not your truck, but it's certainly your labor. It's certainly your willpower, your brains, and your service. And so that's incorporated. In terms of what it does, really, it's not much more complicated than that. It makes it a crime to use immigration status coercively in that way. It avoids that form of exploitation. The constitutional issues were tricky, and I'm willing to go into more detail here, but I think the short version would be Legislative Council and the Department of Justice are both satisfied that we reached a constitutional resolution. So unless you have those questions, I'll set that issue aside.
Okay. Chair Barker, members of the committee, I'm Peter Threlkeld, Director of the Corporation Division for the Secretary of State's Office, here to speak to you about House Bill 4128. At the Corporation Division, we educate, commission, and regulate notaries public in Oregon. The parts of the bill that I would like to speak to are really around the coordination of efforts between various enforcement agencies. What occurs today is that the Secretary of State enforces ORS 194, Oregon's notary law. The Attorney General will enforce the Unlawful Practices Unlawful Trade Practices Act. The Oregon State Bar will go after some of these folks for unlawful practice of law, and then the district attorneys are prosecuting criminal activity. The way the system is working now, we each independently get to go and enforce those actions, and under the new law, a conviction in any one of those areas, the Secretary of State will be able to use that as an enforceable action. So we won't have to relitigate cases and actions that have already taken place. We'll be able to rely on the work that others have done with the intent of getting the bad actors out of the commissioned notary population. So that's the we think is a good benefit. Will also allow us that a notary that or a person that has violated these statutes will forever not be able to apply to become a notary public in the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Chair Barker, excuse me, vice chairs, members of the committee, my name is Shapan Salapasai, and today I'm here on behalf of the Department of Justice's Crime Victims Rights Committee, as well as president of the board of the Immigrant Refugee Community Organization. I'm here before you because this, I urge passage of this law. The reason for this bill and the reason for its need is that often community members, vulnerable community members, become victims unintentionally. And this bill came out of the Notarial Task Force, which itself came out of the work done by now Governor, then Secretary of State Kate Brown, to strengthen the laws concerning notarios. The bill is an important law that is important for our immigrant community. I, as an immigration attorney and victims' rights advocate, see daily how people are duped and coerced into giving money that they do not have. Currently, as the task force member for the Department of Justice, we have a case that's pending federally of over 50 victims that are citizens of Oregon who have been duped to give over approximately $1.5 million to two notarios who have worked through five different states. This is a daily occurrence in our community. This is what I see. And the task force came together and to work collectively because we realize that these 50 individuals do not have a voice when it comes through our legal system. So I urge passage. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Barker, vice chairs, and representatives. My name is John Haraldson. I am the Benton County District Attorney. And my role as District Attorney is to use the criminal statutes to enforce our laws, but to really, the bottom line is protecting the citizens of our community. Now, it's an interesting history, the evolution, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, but with notario fraud, that phonetically the word notario is so similar to notary that that becomes an element in the fraud. That coupled with a legal practice of using certifications and stamps together makes it a very attractive option for individuals who are really looking for a legitimate way to gain legal status. Now, their interest is typically piqued by an individual who comes along selling these wares to say, this is a legitimate business, I hold this judicial-like position and have this authority, and if you pay me a significant amount of money, I can get your legal status in order. And so we have individuals who are seeking not to buy a fake ID, but to really go through a process that they believe is legitimate in order to gain legal status. Oftentimes they pay, they wind up getting some paperwork, they think it's real, it's not, and then things go from bad to worse from there. And meanwhile, you have individuals that are preying on victims who are afraid to go to the police to report these matters. And this happened in Benton County. It happened in Benton County in a case where, fortunately, we were able to utilize to the Department of Justice somebody who could go undercover, but it was a challenge. And I can tell you that if we did not have that of individual in play, that we would have wound up with a van of materials that were used to create these documents and less prosecution options. But with the bill that's being proposed, it would give us tools to be able to have greater protections and accountability for a dynamic that, in its current state, creates an opportunity to victimize people with impunity. The bill, as presented, would allow for an alignment between the coercion statute and now what's proposed as the extortion statute, which is necessary based upon a Supreme Court ruling in a case we refer to as the Robertson case. And so this would be a positive step in that direction. The final point that I would make with respect to the obstruction of judicial administration, that would provide us the tool necessary to go forward with these cases even if we don't have a victim. Let's say our victim's gone back to Mexico and we have no way to bring them back. We could still go forward with these cases because they have to do with the fraud. And once we can prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the fraud occurred, then we can begin to hold these individuals accountable. Thank you, and I would certainly be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Questions from the panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Close the public hearing on House Bill 4128. Open a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4128 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Leininger moves House Bill 4128 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Yes.
Just briefly, I forgot to thank Nancy Kramer, who did an amazing job as the administrator of our task force.
Great, thank you. Any further discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Vega Peterson and Representative Gallegos will co-carry. Thank you. Open a public hearing on House Bill 4087. Oh, I'm sorry. We'll open 4066. Representative Huffman, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, this bill, 4066, comes to you from Representative Huffman, and it deals with one of our favorite topics, which are drones. This bill does quite a few things. It makes it a Class A misdemeanor if a person operates unmanned aircraft system called a UAS that is capable of firing a bullet or other projectile or otherwise operating it as a dangerous weapon. It modifies the definition of UAS so that it applies to all flying machines, not just big machines. This now incorporates model aircraft. It removes from the felony crime of endangering aircraft small UASs to get at situations in which a person might swat a towel or try to brush away a drone, and if it should crash, perhaps that's not a felony crime. It creates the new violation of reckless interference with an aircraft. It requires public bodies using UASs to establish policies and procedures on the use, storage, access, sharing, and retention of data collected from that operation, and it requires the policy be made available to the public. There are four amendments before you today. Three of them come from the House Judiciary Committee. One of them comes from Rep. Huffman. The proposed -1 amendment removes the prohibition on establishment of probable cause through public body data gathered without a warrant. The proposed -3 amendments remove the private right of action against an operator who flies a UAS in compliance with FAA authorization. It also creates a violation if a person knowingly or intentionally operates a UAS over a critical facility and defines what a critical facility is. The proposed -4 adds a mental state of intentional, knowing, or reckless to weaponization of drones and provides until January 1, 2017 for public bodies to come up with their policies and procedures. And the proposed -6 amendments incorporate the -3 amendments but put a sunset on the critical facilities provisions. This is to perhaps alleviate concerns over federal preemption. This is not ready to move today.
Okay. Kevin Campbell, Aaron Knott, and Matt Marquis, please.
Hi, Chair Barker. It was fun appearing before your committee today. Chair Barker, committee members, John Huffman, State Rep for House District 59. I thought I would come up and fill you with all kinds of information about this bill, and then I thought better. And that's why these gentlemen are up here, because quite frankly, probably what I should just say is that House Bill 4066, as amended, is a product of our permanent UAS work group. And so we work really hard to be at the table and come to a consensus. And then you get in the building and you have a LC drafting error. And all of a sudden, state agencies are coming out of the woodwork. And I'm going, wait, the bill doesn't do that. And then Aaron gets with me and it says, actually, the way it was drafted, it does. And so we've spent the last week going back and forth and back and forth. And these gentlemen here are ready and available to explain and answer questions about what we actually really have today. And Ms. Newell, of course, can do a great job of directing that, too. So, Mr. Chair, having said that, if you would excuse me, I'll get back to House rules and let these guys do the heavy lifting. Okay. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Kevin Campbell. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association and the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police to speak in favor of House Bill 4066. I believe, and there's been a number of amendments that are circulating around, but I believe the Dash 6 amendments incorporate the pieces that I've had a chance to work on. I do want to thank Council Newell, because she has dealt with a very complicated subject between what the FAA may or may not do, what they've done so far, their instructions. Frankly, they move very slow in an environment that seems to be developing quickly. And so I appreciate the fact that we're, in a way, we have to thread the needle a little bit. So once session started, we continue to have a conversation, and I believe the Dash 6 amendments accomplish the things that are important. I do want to mention just a couple quick things. First of all, what the amendment does is it eliminates one line out of Section 7. We do have a requirement in the bill that law enforcement agencies that are going to deploy this technology need to have established policies, and those agencies need to make those policies available to the public, which is great. There was another line added that created a pretty burdensome log process, which wasn't appropriate. Law enforcement agencies that are already seeking warrants for the use of a drone in a number of situations are not in a position to make available to the public or to log specific flights. And so that is removed in the Dash 6, as is all of Section 9. I think I'll let Aaron Knott speak to that specifically. The other thing I want to mention, and I think Mr. Marquillo mentioned this, we support the concept of adding critical facilities and making sure that drones are not utilized in that environment. I know the FAA may take action at some point to deal with that, which explains the sunset. There are a number of facilities that you will all recognize immediately as critical. I want to mention correction facilities. That was added in the Dash 6. We already know of instances around the nation where drones are being used, flying into, you wouldn't be surprised by this, into correctional facilities to drop off all kinds of things. And so this bill would prohibit the use of a drone in those environments. And with that, I want to thank the committee, Council Newell, and all of you that have worked on this, including Representative Huffman, who has been long-suffering in our many conversations about the bill. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to the gentleman to my right.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Attorney General in the Oregon Department of Justice. First, I think I'll respectfully file a motion to amend the previous testimony. I believe it's the Dash 4s, not the Dash 6s.
Is it?
Committee counsel is nodding, and I'll flesh that out a little bit, sort of what does what. But first of all, a bit of an overview about what this bill actually does, and then some of the changes that are being made by the amendments. Of the real lift on the regulation of drones was made, I believe, in 2013. And since then, Representative Huffman has been chairing a standing committee on drones that's been both trying to keep us up to speed with federal rulemaking, which is an ever-evolving process in this area, and also looking at the adequacy of our state-side regulatory structure. This bill does a number of different things. One, it creates a violation if an individual is interfering with the use of a plane in terms of taking off or landing, or if you direct a drone into a plane. Now, the reason that this is a violation and not a crime is because the crime of reckless endangerment, which is a Class A misdemeanor, still exists and would be readily prosecutable in any case where the operation of a plane, operation of a drone, caused a plane to have to react in a way that constituted a threat to persons, property, loss of life. So that provision is really aimed more at, hey, I'm trying to take off, but somebody won't stop flying a drone in my flight path. It's that kind of a thing. Second of all, there's a provision which one of the bills amends, which prohibits the weaponization of a drone. You cannot create a drone which then becomes a dangerous condition. And in terms of how this is written, it's broad. You can't put a gun on a drone, I think, would be the archetypal example, but you also can't knowingly or intentionally operate a drone that you know to be dangerous. Now, there's an amendment that's necessary on this point. It's contained in the dash fours, I believe. Yes, it is. The dash fours. Basically, the way the crime was written in the original version of the bill, it didn't have a mental state. First of all, that's very unusual in the criminal code. You're supposed to have criminal intent. But even more than that, if your drone, say, crashed and part of it came off, not all the way off, but you have a sharp piece of metal and you didn't see it, and that metal eventually hits somebody, it's not even negligence necessarily that that would have happened to you. There's no criminal intent there. So because this is a Class A misdemeanor, we felt it was important that there be a criminal intent element. As the bill came out, it required warrants to be used for the gathering, for the admissibility of any information in any proceeding. The problem with that, and the reason why we're pulling it for more consideration, and we think this was really authentically a drafting error, warrants cannot be used by public agencies. The Department of Environmental Quality, for example, can't get a warrant. Police can get warrants. District attorneys can get warrants. That's it. So we're kicking that issue for another time. Similarly, there were some lines in Section 7. Section 7 does two things. As written, it requires public bodies to sort of generate policies and procedures available to the public saying, okay, if we're going to use a drone, this is how we're using the drone, this is what we're using it for. But then as written, it had a log requirement that once we got into talking about that, we're concerned about the burden that would put on not just public agencies, but law enforcement. So we set that issue aside for now. So the two amendments you need from that perspective to get rid of the war requirement, make the other changes I discussed, are dash one and dash the dash sixes, which I think are the other amendments that are in play, I'll leave to Mr. Marquis to describe. They have to do with critical infrastructure facilities and the removal of a private right of action for infractions by commercial drones. So I will leave that to Mr. Marquis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Matt Marquis representing the American Chemistry Council today. And just for the record, as far as the bill is drafted, we have no position on the bill. We are in support of actually the dash threes. There is one slight difference between the dash threes and the dash sixes, and that would be a sunset. And we would prefer to go without a sunset if that is at all possible. We feel the dash threes would help solve a safety issue or a concern over critical facilities by creating a no-fly zone. The critical facilities that we're talking about in this amendment would be things like power generating facilities, natural gas facilities, chemical plants, things that if you had a crash would cause some serious concern to the community. We worked with Representative Huffman's work group, and we think this is a good compromise that we've come up with to help solve this need. Actually, now that I think about the dash threes, I do not think contain Mr. Campbell's addition to a critical facility of the public safety types of things, and we have no issue with that addition to the critical facilities, and be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Post.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a little confused. I think Aaron or Kevin, the dash four, I don't see anything. You said something about the criminal portion, that it was in the dash four, and I'm not seeing that. I'm missing that. It's not there.
Chair Barker, Representative Post, the addition of a mental state that I made reference to is at lines one and two of the dash four amendments. On page one, after line 27, after person, insert intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly. Okay. Those are your sort of we call it the mens rea, but the criminal intent that you have to have.
Okay. So, I'm sorry. May I follow?
Please.
Thank you. Okay. So, I want to see how many people I can make happy in one day. So, with everybody on this, so you, Matt, and Kevin, the dash 3 and the dash 4 would work well together for your issues, but I heard a dash 1 as well. So I'm just curious where everybody's at on this.
Chair Barker and Representative Post, maybe I can do this simply.
Yeah.
The dash 1, Aaron and I both support. I don't think that Mr. Markey cares about the dash 1. The dash 4s, Aaron and I support completely. So that leaves the dash 3s and the dash 6s. I think the difference is in the dash 3s, there's no mention of correction or law enforcement facilities, but in the dash 6s, there is a sunset. For the record, just to clarify, our position is that we think correctional facilities and law enforcement facilities should be added. But to be honest with you, I don't have an opinion or a problem with whether there's a sunset or not. That's not of importance to me. I don't know what the considerations are. But so I guess if there was another amendment brought forward that the committee supported that included corrections and law enforcement facilities and didn't include a sunset, I could support that as well. So.
And Chair Bark and Rep Post, the dash 6s do include correctional facilities and law enforcement facilities as protected critical facilities, and they have a sunset. And the reason the sunset is put on there is that the FAA has complete jurisdiction over flight. And when we impose a restriction on flight, we get into this federal issue. And if there is a lawsuit that comes along, this portion of the statute could be invalidated because of that. The FAA hasn't developed rules yet that apply to this particular situation. So the thought on the sunset is while the FAA is developing these rules about critical facilities, we, the state, can put some parameters and protections in place that will eventually sunset or be renewed so that we lessen the likelihood of having a federal challenge.
Mr. Chair, may I just add to that?
Yes,
and I totally agree with what counsel just said. I think there are existing concerns with some of our current statute as well around this area. And the sunset provisions would only, the way I read it, go towards this critical facility piece and not those other questions. So you're going to have to readdress the situation regardless if you have a sunset or if you don't have a sunset. I think if the FAA makes this determination, that's why it would be our preference to just keep them both the same without a sunset.
Okay. President Springer.
Well, yeah, okay, I will. I figured that Representative Barton was going to ask the same question and do a better job of it than I am. So I've got a
doubtful,
point to him.
I seriously doubt that. Just wording. Well,
work with me here, counsel. So we have sunsets on lots of things, and we are always running alongside or against or under federal law. I'm sitting here and I'm thinking, if there is no sunset and federal law changes, we come in and we change, like we do on lots of laws. I don't see why we need the sunset in case the federal law changes. But am I missing something?
Chair Barker, Rep Springer, I think the answer to that is that we know that the federal law on this will change. And we know that it's going to be something that has rules developed on it that will make this possibly an invalid law in the future. This work group intends over the next session to look at privacy issues in particular. Whether it picks up this issue hasn't been determined. So the sunset is there to give an end date so that if nothing else changes, this will end. And if we want to continue with having this state protection, we can come back and do that. But if it's not necessary, if the FAA has developed rules on it, then it will end automatically.
Okay. So then we'll see if Representative Barton does much greater job than I just did.
Actually, may I, Mr. Chair? Now this is, I think, the third UAV bill that we've seen, first 13, 15, and now this one. And it was, I could be mistaken, but my recollection was that we never previously had purported to have any jurisdiction to regulate above, I want to say 400 feet. I thought above 400 feet is clear federal jurisdiction. Has that changed?
Chair Barker, Rep. Barton, recently the FAA put out guidance specifically saying that all airspace in small UAS operation is within their jurisdiction. There has been ongoing debate across multiple states and jurisdictions and federal districts on the preemption issue, as it's called, and whether the federal government regulates even the airspace that's around your home and in your backyard, or whether it's 400 feet or above. That is not a settled matter, and okay. It is quite in debate at the moment.
So just do you mind if I ask a few follow-ups? Representative Krieger, do you mind? I know you have some questions as well. after you. I'll defer to my better. Okay. So if I just want to make sure, I'm pretty sure what you're saying is not at all clear that we have any authority to enact this law. Is that right? We can enact it to enforce it.
No, Brett Barton, there are certain public safety issues that are very clearly within the arena of what the state can legislate on. But when you put a hard number on where flight can and can't happen, The FAA has jurisdiction in that specific area. So when you say flights 400 feet or flights in this specific area, you run into an issue where the FAA has the sole authority to make rules in that area. Now, if you're talking about actions in that area, and if you're talking about public safety, then the state has room to do work there.
Boy, that's messy.
Yep.
Representative Krieger.
On line 28, where it says projectiles, which are the present state agencies, Department of Fish and Wildlife, farmers, ranchers are delivering medications by fixed-wing aircraft, helicopters, and such. It'd be much more efficient for them to start using drones when they go out and locate different things, hit a specific animal with medications. Is this going to keep them from being able to do that? Because it doesn't, the where it says fires a bullet or projectile, and then it goes on, or other operates in our, to cause assistance to function as a dangerous weapon, but that's not included in the front. So I think you may be taking the efficiency in the future of farming, ranching, of wildlife management, a tool away that would be a huge savings. They're already starting to use them to go out and survey herds of animals, herds of domestic animals, cattle ranches. You can send it out 2-3 miles and back. He can sit in his house and monitor it on the scope.
Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, that is an amazing point. At no point, I think, as far as I know, has a public body come in to our group and stated a desire to use a projectile with drones, and that's a valid use. I think that's a good point, a point we need to take under advisement. So I'd be happy to follow up with committee counsel on that after the hearing.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Barker. And following up on Representative Krieger's point, this is going to be a long comment and then a question. With all due respect to Representative Huffman, I've shared this concern with him in the previous bills, which I've voted against, and I plan to do that again here. This feels a bit to me like it's the internet circa 1995 and we're regulating it before we really know what this technology means, what the implications are. Representative Krieger just came up with an example that I certainly never would have thought of, and there are going to be many, many, many more like that we here cannot anticipate. And that's fine, but we should have a good reason to, I think, regulate this incipient technology. To that end, a question, and perhaps you might be best positioned to answer this, Mr. Nye. If not, that's no problem. So Section 7, the part about the public bodies, correct me if I'm wrong, but right now, for example, law enforcement or other public entities can and do fairly often, reconnaissance from the air, whether it be helicopter, plane, etc. No warrant is required, etc. In fact, that is often used, the reconnaissance is used for as a basis of probable cause to get a warrant. Would this bill, in essence, be placing more restrictions on a cheaper and safer technology than is currently used with helicopters and planes right now?
Chair Barker, Representative Barton, as originally written, absolutely. That's the reason for the Dash 1 amendments in part. I think you hit it square on the head. The way this bill came out of the gate, and again, everybody's claiming this is a drafting error, you would have needed a warrant for anything. If you were similarly situated to a traffic helicopter or another object that's doing plain view under Dow Chemicals or other visible space cases, you would nonetheless have required a warrant. The Dash 1 amendment does seem to solve that. In the spirit of your earlier comment, if you don't mind my...
Please.
I'd note that Representative Krieger made an exceptional point, but I think that the basic attempt that this bill is making in large part is very much in what I would consider good state regulatory space insofar as it's oriented first and foremost with criminal behavior, threats to persons or property, even when the internet was very new. You don't want to kill the goose that's laying the golden egg. At the same time, insofar as it's being used for fraud, financial exploitation, wire fraud, things of that nature, the state traditionally has a very aggressive regulatory space there. Similarly here, no matter what you do with the drone technology, I think we're all in agreement that you don't want them operated in a way that poses a risk to persons or property, and I think that's sort of at the core of what we're doing.
Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Next we'll call Kimberly McCullough, Kenji Sugihara, and Hasina Squires.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Kimberly McCullough. I'm here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. We have been participating in this work group since its inception, and over the interim, the group met many, many, many times. We worked very, very hard, and I'd like to just start by thanking Representative Huffman for facilitating such an open and collaborative process between a very large number of stakeholders. And in particular as well, I'd like to thank Council Newell for keeping us on track and for providing us with a huge amount of research as we went along, and it was extremely helpful to the group. We are very happy with what we accomplished as a group. We think that this bill is a good bill. We support it enthusiastically, in large part because of how hard everyone worked on it. And I want to just go through a few of the reasons why we like the bill and talk about the amendments a little bit. First of all, there are some adjustments to crimes that are in the bill. We think they're reasonable. There's, in particular, the addition of a violation for the use of a drone to interfere with an aircraft when it doesn't rise to the level of actually reckless endangerment. Keeping that as a violation, we think, is very reasonable. And the other crimes that are discussed there or that are included in the bill, we worked really hard to try to find a balance there. So I think that actually is accomplished. As far as the provisions relating to public bodies and the public bodies having to have policies that they publish, we think this is a huge step forward. Right now, we don't really know, as the public, we don't really know what our public bodies are doing with drones. So this creates some transparency and an opportunity for people in the public to have some idea about what's happening. We also have concerns about data collection by public bodies, so requiring them to have some sort of policy that says, this is how long we're keeping the data, this is how we're protecting it, that's a good thing. And I think that will help facilitate transparency and open communication about that. One of the things that we were concerned about and we remain concerned about, and this is just to flag this issue for you for the future, is the fact that we have a warrant requirement or exigent circumstances for law enforcement to use drones for surveillance, but we don't have any restriction on the data that's collected by public bodies and then shared with law enforcement. And so the way that we see that is that it's a potential, not necessarily that this is the way that it's being used right now, but that it's a potential backdoor for surveillance by law enforcement. Simply get another agency to do that surveillance and give you the data. That was where the provision came from that was in the bill that unfortunately was drafted far more severely than what any of us intended. What we were trying to do was limit the sharing of data between public agencies or public bodies and law enforcement. But the way that it was written, it actually rolled back the decision that was made in 2013 to allow law enforcement to use drones when there's exigent circumstances. So it was drafted too extreme. We took the whole thing out. But our hope is that we will continue to have a conversation about that, what we see as a back door that's left open. In the interests of getting everything done in a short session, we're totally happy to continue that conversation into the future. Another provision that I just wanted to state on the record that that we did originally have an issue with, but we don't now, is the provision that relates to the critical facilities. In an earlier LC draft, it actually limited what you could or couldn't record with a drone. And we had some First Amendment concerns about that, that if a drone is in a place where it's legally authorized to be, saying you can or can't record this, you bump up against the First Amendment. So it was changed to now be a no-fly zone, and that doesn't have the same First Amendment concerns that we had. So we are neutral about that. Let's see here. As far as the addition of the mental state in the Dash 4 amendment, we think that we support that as well, and think that just having a mental state there is consistent with other criminal laws, and so we do support that in the Dash 4 as well. And I think that's about it. So thank you.
Okay.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Kenji Sugihara. I'm an attorney, and I'm also a hobbyist. So I've been fortunate enough to be part of the work group, and I also want to say thank you, Ms. Newell, for all of your hard work and the many hours that you've put in. I've spent some of those hours with you, and I also want to say thank you to Representative Huffman for all his work, and Senator Przanski, too, for bringing this group together. As was said, there was many, many hours spent putting this together. It was a big consensus building activity. There were some parts of the proposals that we brought before the group, and they weren't taken forward. So it's been thought out, and a process is we went through a long process. The critical facilities was a recent addition, and at first, like the ACLU, I had some significant First Amendment concerns with the filming. I actually showed off one of my videos, which was in North Portland, which showed the video. And there were some critical infrastructure, critical facilities in the background. I said, hey, you know, I didn't do this to be surveillance or anything bad. So I said, there's some issues there. Can we really take a look at that? And the amendment was brought forth that said, okay, don't fly over it, which totally makes sense. You know, as a hobbyist, you shouldn't be flying your drones over natural gas plants or dams. That's just not smart. So with the changes that have been made or the amendments that have been proposed, I fully back it. I back the amendments, and I back the original 4066 proposal. I also want to mention that a lot of the issues are up in the air with the FAA, as was mentioned before. There are some lawsuits percolating through the system in the federal side, which could define how much property you own over your property, or how much airspace you own over your property. So that's in the works. The FAA reauthorization bill is coming up, so there's some things coming up there, and there's some other commercial-related FAA type of legislation coming up, too. But I also want to say, Representative Krieger, that was fairly surprising. It was really good to hear about possibly ranchers using UAS to deliver medicine to herd animals. That was quite good to hear. So with that, if you have any questions after we're done testifying, I'm happy to answer them.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Hasina Squires here today on behalf of Amazon.com. I don't think it's any secret that Amazon has made it very clear that we intend at some point in the future to be able to deliver packages via the use of drones. So I'm here to support the Dash 3 amendment, specifically on page 2, lines 3 through 5. That's our language. That language would add to the existing exemptions in the bill for the authority to bring a private right of action to commercially used drones that are approved by the FAA. And Mr. Marquis has also included that language in his critical facilities language because it's entirely possible that one of those critical facilities might want to have a package delivered to them by Amazon. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. We did participate in the work group, and there was a tremendous amount of work that went into this bill.
Any questions for this panel? Representative Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kimberly, a question for you. I should also note beforehand, now that I trashed on Representative Huffman's bill, of the three UAV bills, I think this one is the most narrowly written and also focused most on public safety, and I'm still deciding whether or not to support it. This is the best of the three that I've yet seen. I appreciate all the work that went into it. And I'm asking you this in part because I don't have the amendments in front of me. But as I read it, the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office has made no secret that it's interested in using drones for Mount Hood search and rescue operations. Mm-hmm. It seems like an obvious use for a public entity, just the kind of exigent circumstances, potentially in that case, a search and rescue that would be allowed. There's nothing in any of these amendments or the bill as written that would preclude that use, correct?
Correct. There's nothing that would, Representative Barker, Chair Barker, Representative Barton, there is nothing in the amendments that would preclude that. The language that was agreed to in 2013 requires a warrant for surveillance, but it has an exception for exigent circumstances, and search and rescue type situation would easily fall within that. And we have done there. If we didn't amend it, there would be a problem here at the bottom of page three, mm-hmm. Because. Page three, basically, it takes out those exceptions, and that was, again, that was a drafting error, and we're taking that out, so, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to close the public hearing, carry over the work session until tomorrow on the 4066 and 4087. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 4118.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, this is a bill from Representative Hurd. It allows for local circuit courts to review a contested agency civil penalty. If the amount in question is $10,000 or greater, the hearing is before a circuit court judge, and the petitioner has a right to a jury trial. If the amount is less than $10,000, the hearing is in small claims court. This bill is not ready to move today, and there are no amendments before you.
Okay, thank you. You can go ahead and have the order, please, Representative Hurd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to start off by saying thank you for allowing us to come in here and let our voice be heard on this bill. So, colleagues, I'll just start off with this. So, I'm not an attorney. You all know that. And I've not actually had the displeasure of going through this process of which this bill is focused on. But my father here, Dick Hurd, and he'll testify in a minute, I've watched him go through this process in years past with his company. And I've heard so many horror stories from different constituents and whatnot about the difficulty of once you have been fined by a state agency in our state, how difficult it is to actually fight back if you feel you've been wronged. And so that's really the genesis of this bill for me. So, you know, just some background on, you know, this kind of a bill and what I hope to see come from it, whether it's this year or in the years to come, it really is what motivated me to run for the state house. I want the citizens of Oregon to have every opportunity possible to prove their innocence. And have as fair and just of a trial or a hearing, but also the outcome be fair and just as possible. So at this point, unless you have questions for me, I'm going to turn it over to my father, and then Mr. Sagowski will follow up after him.
Chairman Barker and committee, thank you for having me here today. My name is Dick Hurd, and I own a farm and a wastewater treatment facility in Southern Oregon. They work in conjunction with each other. we take in probably 95% of the rural septage from Eugene to the California border over to Brookings up to Yahats, and then we also serve 17 cities with their biosolids in that we treat cities everywhere from Oak Lodge Sanitary District in Milwaukee to Cambie, most of the coastal cities. And we also take in all the grease trap waste from all the restaurants in southern Oregon and the rest areas, parks, recreation areas. We like to say if you live in southern Oregon that you depend on our facility every day. And a few years ago, a facility like this, we take in this material and we hold it in the wintertime, and then we treat it, and then we put it on our farm for fertilizer and irrigation to grow grass and so forth and feed for stock. So, but a facility like ours, even though it's very green, we do it without any impact on the waters of the state at all. And those 20 million gallons are thick waste is used to go into a wastewater treatment plants in the cities where they really weren't set up for that, and it ended up in the river, most of it. So that it serves a real purpose, but the worst problem that we run into is odor. And so we've been working at that very hard for years and years. And a few years ago, though, we had a lot of trouble with it, and we were working through the process. We had hired CH2ML to do a study for us, and they pretty much had what they needed to do figured out. But in the meantime, we had our annual inspection, and the DEQ came through for our inspection. And where our facility was regulated, the facility by solid waste and our discharge by water quality, which is two different parts of the DEQ. They went through both of them at the same time on the same day. Solid waste gave us a letter of compliance that said that we met all the conditions of our permit. And water quality wrote us a $76,000 fine for an inadequate screen on our headworks, which was, of course, a part of the facility, was not part of water quality's purview. They obviously couldn't get solid waste to write that, and so they had a fellow who would write it in water quality, and he did. So at that point, I was very angry, and I talked to my attorney, Wally, and I said, Wally, I want to fight that. That was really wrong, what they did there. And I said, if we ever get that before a jury, there's no way that anybody, the proponents of facts are going to be on our side. We couldn't lose that case. We have to take that to court. And he said, well, that would be true if you were going to get it in front of a jury. But you're not going to get it in front of a jury. You're going to go to an administrative judicial judge. And the possibility of you winning there is little to none. And I said, I can't believe that, Wally. I said, the facts are all on our side here. They have obviously overstepped their bounds. And we will prevail. He said, well, it won't happen that way. In the meantime, because we went through all the steps to do the right stuff. We had our engineering done at that point. We were moving forward. We were spending $742,000 to seal our facility. To seal our facility. And we burned off all the greenhouse gases at that point, and that pretty well took care of the odor and all everything else. And the department at that point had reduced our fine to $4,300. But I was still a knothead in the farmer sense. I wanted to go and have my day in court. And so I told Wally, I said, I still want to go tell my story. And he said, well, if you do that, you're going to throw that $4,300 settlement out the window, and you're going to go and take a chance on a $76,000 fine, and it's going to cost you $37,000 for us to fight it for you. And I was still stubborn, and I went anyway. And he was right. I lost. Okay. Well, fortunately, the DEQ was kind enough, because in most cases, we have a very good working relationship with the DEQ. And they again offered me that settlement in the courtroom so that the judge could not raise that up past $4,300. But still, we lost the case, and the judge wrote an 80-page decision. Of course, that since you have to appeal every page, that would have cost me another $50,000 to appeal it. And so I would have been $80,000 in on a $4,300 fine at that point. It was a little ridiculous, even for a hard head like me. And so,
Mr. Chair, I'm starting to understand Dallas Heard.
Yes.
This is a much more reasonable version.
Yeah.
It's so, genetics.
Anyway, we obviously decided to drop the case at that point. And so the thing that I'm doing is, you know, you guys have the daunting task of standing in between these agencies and the people who you represent. And, you know, I think of if we had a room here of 50 people that had been fined, and you ask them, is there a possibility that you would like to at least have a choice as to whether or not you want to take your case before a jury or a duly elected judge? I doubt that any of them are going to raise their hand and say, no, I don't even want the choice. I just want to go to court and be judged by a judicial system that is basically working for the agency that fined me. And so, with that in mind, I'd just like to appeal to you to put something like this through and let the people have an opportunity for justice. So, thank you.
Mr. Chair, before we move on to Wally here, I'd like to add just a couple things. A small case study that my staff and I did, we found in the periods of 2005 and 7 that roughly 78% of these cases where the people of Oregon were appealing a fine that had been issued to them by an agency, the agencies prevailed in 78% of the cases. Of the 22% that the people prevailed, up to 20% of those rulings that went in favor of the citizen were either heavily modified or completely overturned by the agency. So let's think about that. The agency puts the fine on you, then you go in front of the administrative law judge. And every agency, is the way I understand it, is a little different from the one to the other. I think that's right, Representative Barton. So they kind of make their own rules, then they kind of make up their own court system. It's really favorable for them. But in some cases, in some agencies, as many as 20% of those cases were overturned by that same agency once the judge went against the agency. So it's a pretty bad situation we put our people in against us, the state. And so with that.
Well, I'm Wallace Sagowski. I've been a lawyer in Oregon for 42 years, in New Mexico for a long time, in Arizona. I got called out of a happy retirement working on developing a nanotechnology company with this argument, so I got involved again. When I started the practice of law back in 74, I believe the state of Oregon regulations to enforce your laws covered about 18 inches on my bookshelf. By the time I left Oregon to practice in New Mexico in 2000, I think I had four racks in a standard width bookcase full of your state's regulations to enforce your laws. And through all of that, if you don't mind, I'd like to tell you kind of what I perceive and experience with all of this. The APA Act, of course, David Frohnmayer was its biggest champion, and we argued about it at law school, and we discussed it, and he felt the APA was great because it took the decisions away from the elected judges who were ignorant and knew nothing about government and brought it to specialists who would make quick and efficient decisions. And what happened was you then had a situation where you passed the laws, it went to the agencies administered by the agencies, and they made the regulations. Your chance to review your regulations the agencies made was pretty skinny, actually. First of all, you're not in session that long. Two, there's not enough of you. And three, you don't have huge staffs to help you. So the agencies basically have a free run at making regulations. If they don't run afoul of the governor, the attorney general, or the court system somewhere, their regulations stand. So then the agency goes to the citizen and says, hey, this is the rule. So the agency, you say, well, you know, I don't think so. The agency says, well, let's have a hearing. So you go to the agency, and they discuss with you before this formal hearing over here, before it becomes a formally contested case, and they find all their facts, and they make a decision. You say, I don't like it. So then you're at contested case. For contested case, you get not a fact-finding judge, really. You get an administrative law judge. And all he's really interested in, and all I've ever seen them interested in, is did the agency comply with the agency's rules? So essentially, the citizen faces an agency set of rules, an agency-related judge, and his recourse out of that is not to an elected fact-finding judge, but to the Court of Appeals. And the Court of Appeals doesn't really find facts. It doesn't accept any evidence. All it does is play with the evidence that comes up from the agency's contested case hearing. And once you get to the Court of Appeals, if they make a decision in your favor, the agency's pretty well had. But if it's making it at the level of the administrative law judge, the agency gets another shot at it. It gets to go back and modify the agency's rulings. Some agencies have the right to make the final decision themselves, regardless of what the administrative law judge says, and some agencies are forced to comply with the administrative law judge. So you see the citizen, the little guy out in the country, faces the tremendous expense of the whole process. Richard talks about what his lawyer cost him. He doesn't seem to think the engineers were, he seems to think the engineers and the accountants were free, but they weren't. There was an additional huge bill for them. And I would estimate that Richard, in his own time, my time, the engineer's time, the accountant's time, we talked to land use planners, I would guess he's well over $200,000 in that little dispute. Now, in that dispute, DEQ knew that they had no claim that his headworks was a violation. And the fact they didn't even seriously argue it in the hearing. But they held the $65,000 portion of the fine for the headworks over his head all the way through all those hearings, not taking it off the table, telling Dick that, hey, you know, you go to the hearing, you take the chance that they're going to enforce our $65,000 fine. So Dick, not being a sophisticated attorney and not really trusting any attorney, including his own, didn't have any assurance here that he wasn't going to be subject to this ugly fine if he defended himself and fought the case. He just, being stubborn, you know, took the chance. And he was right, and they couldn't have enforced the fine, but he spent a couple $100,000 in time and effort defending against what, in essence, turned out finally a decision against him, which gave him $4,000 or $5,000 in housekeeping fines. Mm-hmm. So, it's beyond belief, and you can understand why the citizens hate your agencies. My view of this little piece of law, and it's a minor bill, we admit, and it's not covering drones and your backyard and all of that. What it's talking about is the citizen's right to get to elected fact-finding judges in at least some little slice of this process. What you've got is a feeling by your citizenry that, quite frankly, the agencies are not being properly controlled. The agencies have the deck far too stacked in their favor, and I think an awful lot of your citizens would just like to be able to get to their elected judges. This is a state where we have elected judges. Our purpose was to have elected judges, so the government would be reined in and tied to the people. The people elect their judges. The judges sit over there. You sit over here. You make your laws. The executive enforces them, and we were to have a bounce for the citizens by having their cases decided by elected judges. That's all I got. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Krieger.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but the agency picks the judge out of the pool. Isn't that right?
The agency can reject the judge. I think the pool picks the judge.
Well, I understood it was different than that.
Okay.
I had dealt with this issue in 2003 on another case and came forward with Senator Roland, Claussen Oysters, and I know that's a little bit different, $25,000 fine for a screen for 5 pounds of mud at the facility that went down a drain, that same mud could legally be taken off of the barge, off the same oysters, into the same bay with the same water 300 yards away. There doesn't seem sometimes to be any justice in some of these agencies' desire of their enforcement people. You know, as a state police officer, I would have never imposed something like that on somebody. It's not right. And there doesn't seem to be anything about justice sometimes with these deals. And I had a conversation with Judge Brewer when he was chief of the appeals court about what we could do with this, and he did have some suggestions. Get a hold of me.
Okay.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Yes.
May I make one more statement, Mr. Chair, before I leave? So just to kind of finish things up, and again, thank you for allowing us to come before you today, and thank you, committee members, for hearing us. Just to kind of give you some background, since you don't have it, but I do, with why my father decided to engage the DEQ after that fine and spend that much money for so little payback, even if he was fully successful in getting rid of the fine. He'd been beat to death for a decade plus at that point by this agency. And it's just one agency. And it's not that those people are inherently bad people. The system is flawed. We have allowed a system to develop that is becoming a cancer, that is destroying the citizens' chances of having a fair hearing and a fair outcome. And it's so bad that I've even seen some circumstances with one particular agency where they issued two citations that can lead to a fine, where they admittedly didn't even go to the site to inspect it. They looked at some pictures that somebody sent them. They issued the citations that will lead, after a third one, to a fine. Once we pressed them on that issue, they threw out the citations because they acknowledged that once they actually went on site to do a real investigation. I mean, Representative Krieger, you would never give someone a ticket without actually seeing the evidence yourself, I'm assuming.
Better not.
Exactly. Same with you, Representative Olson and Representative Springer, from your law enforcement backgrounds. Andy, why are you smiling like that? Anyway, the point is that's the direct result of such a lack of control we have over our agencies. It's just the Wild West out there, and we are their victims. It can happen to any of us, representatives, regular folks on the street. We're all the little guy or the little gal, as I always say, when it comes to dealing with the state of Oregon. Doesn't matter whether you're worth $1 or $1 billion. So,
thank you very much. Next, we call Stephen Wolf and Kevin Mannix, please.
That's Vice Chair Olson. I apologize. No, it's right.
Do you want Mr. Wolf to go first, or shall I?
You guys choose yourselves.
Go ahead.
Just remember to identify yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman, we go
ahead. Chair Barker, Vice Chairs, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Wolf. I'm the Chief Counsel of the General Counsel Division of the Oregon Department of Justice.
I'm Kevin Mannix. I'm an attorney in private practice in Salem and a former member of the House and the Senate and a former member of this committee.
Chair Barker, I'm here mostly to provide a couple of technical observations about the bill. You know, we do have some concerns about the bill in terms of the cost that it could impose on agencies. From my own perspective, the General Counsel Division provides the day-to-day services to most of the agencies of the state. And as part of those services, we represent agencies in most of the contested case hearings that they have in this state. One of the effects of this bill would be, yes, some work would move away from the General Counsel Division, but it would just go to the Trial Division and would probably be more costly for them to do than it is for us. We think that there are efficiencies in the contested case process that, like any other process, those should constantly be revisited and looked at. We are not so persuaded that moving some of the work away into the court system is the best way to address that, largely because of the potential for multiplicity of outcomes and the additional cost that litigation tends to entail. But the technical points that I wanted to make about the bill are, one of them is that it differentiates between cases that impose fines over $10,000 and those that are under $10,000. Those that are over $10,000, the person can elect to go to court and has the election in the statute to a jury trial. What's not specifically addressed in this bill is that in small claims court, there is a right to a jury trial if the amount in controversy exceeds $750, and that is echoed, that's derived from the state constitution, Article 7, amended Section 3. And so that is just... doesn't appear to have been contemplated in the bill, something that may add to the cost, as jury trials do tend to be a little longer and more costly than non-jury trials. The other technical point is that the bill does not address what happens where a civil penalty is tied to another kind of regulatory action, particularly like a licensure action when we're dealing with the professional boards and commission. And so it's not clear whether the licensure part would be carried to the court action or whether those would follow parallel proceedings, again, with the possibility of differential outcomes, depending upon the forum that it's in front of, and the additional cost of just pursuing two matters at once rather than having it consolidated in a single matter. Those are the principal points that I wanted to make about the bill. I'm perfectly happy to answer any questions that the committee has.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Krieger?
I'm somewhat disappointed when I hear a concern as to the cost to state agencies. I'm more concerned with the cost to citizens of the state of Oregon who have been unjustly put upon. And the last 15 years that I've been here in this committee, too often that appears to take place. And sometimes I think I could even say that there's some vindictiveness within those agencies if you disagree with them.
Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, I bring up the cost only because I think that that's of interest to the committee and to the state. If in fact the determination is made that that cost is worthwhile to fulfill greater interests of justice, well, that's in our name as a department, and we're certainly interested in pursuing that. But we do think previous testimony indicated that in some 70%+ of cases, the agency is upheld in through the administrative process. In some 20%+, it might not be. I think that's my own opinion is that that's pretty good. I would like to think that agencies are only imposing penalties where the evidence is pretty clear that they should be imposed and that's part of the law. We strive for, I think, even greater success in the administrative hearing process than that. But again, you know, the cost issues are something I think that are the legislature's interest, and certainly we would adapt to whatever the legislature chooses to do with these.
Representative Greenberg.
Thank you. You've had a lot of experience with these contested case hearings, and this measure proposes the trigger that allows you to escape a contested case hearing and go directly to the circuit court is a $10,000 fine limit. Are there some things in your experience that you might see as a legitimate reason to move beyond around the contested case hearing right to circuit court rather than through the contested case hearing to appeals court?
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick. I cannot say that in my experience I've experienced a situation of injustice that indicated to me that the contested case process is fundamentally flawed. I think like all of our processes, all of our justice processes, it can be improved. And I know over the years, we've moved from a system where all of the administrative law judges were essentially employees of the agencies or contracted with the agencies that were conducting the hearing to a model now where we have an independent agency that conducts the hearings for the most part. And I think that's been generally to the good in terms of promoting transparency and some even-handedness in the process and providing for a neutral look at these individual cases. I don't know anything personally about the cases that were testified to in the earlier testimony here, or what all of the background and details of how those came about and transpired are. I hope that's responsive to your question.
Thank you. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In these cases where the fine is levied and upheld and paid out, where does the money, like the 70, we have our neighbor actually was signed as fined, I think $72,000 for one instance on their dairy farm. Where does that money go?
Chair Barker, Representative Springer, it largely depends upon which agency is assessing the penalty. Some agencies, the authority is that penalty money goes into a dedicated fund that to continue addressing those kinds of issues, which is under the agency's control. With some agencies and some types of penalties, it goes to the general fund. There's a large number of directions that the money can go, just again, depending upon who's levying the penalty.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow
Thank up. You. So you said general fund, the state general fund. It's my understanding the majority of that money goes back to the agency that levied the fine. Is that correct?
Chair Barker, Representative Springer, I can't speak authoritatively to that. I think that probably ordinarily that's the case. But again, it's subject to whatever limitation and appropriations that the agency has.
Thank you. Mr. Maddox.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm here technically in favor of this bill. I checked that little box on the testimony because I'm not against the bill. I'm certainly not neutral. But I have good news and bad news this afternoon. The good news is this committee is not going to proceed to deal with this issue this session. I think that's the reality. The bad news is we do have a big problem in the state, and it began growing in the 1930s. If you look at the Oregon Constitution, you would think that every citizen has access to the courts anytime there is a difference of opinion between the state and the citizen as to a matter to be adjudicated in criminal law or civil law. But administrative law is a creature that did not exist in 1859 when we adopted the Constitution. And the courts in interpreting that Constitution have said, well, administrative law is a new creature and it has evolved over time. So this constitutional right to go to court to adjudicate a controversy in a civil matter does not extend to all this administrative law, which is this new creature. And in 1973, I think it was, with the Administrative Procedures Act, we statutorily formalized a good deal of what we do with administrative law. All well and good. But the creature has continued to grow. And we're beginning to recognize what we have wrought with this creature. And there is an opportunity here over time to revisit this. We have partially revisited it with legislation that created an independent hearings unit within the executive branch. The issue here really is when a citizen and an agency of the executive branch have a difference of opinion. Now, in this case, this bill talks about fines, but we should also talk about elimination of your license to practice medicine or practice law. We have moved to administrative entities the power over someone's right to be engaged in business or a profession. We have given them complete power in many instances through the regulatory process to impose amazing fines. And the only opportunity for independent judicial inquiry is when you go to the Court of Appeals for review of the determination, and they're going to say if there is substantial evidence to support the findings of fact, we're not touching it, those. If there is substantial reasoning to support the conclusions of law, we're not touching those. So it is a limited scope of review at the appellate level. Now, we had the identical problem in regard to the tax system at the county level and at the state level. And we devised a solution in 1995, and now I'm dating myself. Back in 1995, as a Democrat in the House of Representatives, I sponsored House Bill 2325, pre-session filed, to establish the magistrate division in the tax court, because we do have an elected tax court judge. But before 1995, if you had a beef with county revenue people, you got to go in front of a county revenues officer or hearings officer. If you had a beef with the Department of Revenue statewide, you get to go in front of a Department of Revenue hearings officer, and they would make recommendations to the higher's up in their entities. And then if you were unhappy with those ultimate decisions, you could seek court review, but you were stuck with a limited review as to facts and as to conclusions of law, and you had to go in and retry the case in front of a tax court judge. We changed that. Chapter 650, Oregon Laws 1995, created the Magistrate Division of Tax Court. Now, when you have a beef with the county or the state as to a revenue issue, as to a tax issue, you get to go in front of a magistrate appointed by the elected tax court judge in the judicial branch of government. And I suggest to you respectfully, it is time to evaluate the notion of establishing a magistrate division of the Oregon Court of Appeals, where you take all of those central hearings unit folks, all the folks out there running administrative type hearings, which are really judicial hearings, but they're not in the judicial branch, and put them under the judicial branch. And you can achieve efficiencies there. It's a statewide entity, the Court of Appeals. They could have magistrates appointed to be serving in various parts of the state, or you might choose to allow larger circuit courts to have their own magistrate division. But take all of this administrative adjudication of citizen rights out of the executive branch and put it where it belongs in the judicial branch, with limited increased cost, maybe less cost, but at the same time, a guarantee to the citizenry that they will truly have a hearing in front of an independent magistrate who does not report to anyone in the executive branch. The original determination of our system was you have the legislative branch that makes the laws, you have the executive branch which executes the laws, carries them out, and the judicial branch which is there to adjudicate differences between citizens, but also differences between the state and the individual. We don't have the state police running hearings about criminal justice adjudication, and we never could. It would be a violation of people's various rights under the Constitution. Why is it that we allow the executive branch any power to adjudicate issues between the citizen and that branch? Now, we might determine over time that there are limited controversies that don't rise to the level of sufficiency that you would require this process. It might have to do with driver's licenses and issues like that that are relatively minor, important to the person, but more truly administrative procedures. But when it comes to an agency saying, I am going to fine you $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, shouldn't that citizen have an opportunity to say, all well and good, I challenge this, you go in front of an independent magistrate agency and make your case in front of that magistrate that I did something wrong and that a certain amount of penalty ought to be imposed. I would respectfully recommend to this committee that in the interim, you put together a task force or even a subcommittee or have a special committee assigned to review the administrative law system and come up with something and take a look at Chapter 650 Oregon Laws 1995, a bill which was passed that was sponsored by a Democrat from this community, me, but passed by a Republican House and a Republican Senate. It's a bipartisan issue. It brings in liberal considerations. It brings in conservative considerations of justice for our citizenry. And we've reached that point, I think, in our society here in Oregon where we can address that issue and come up with a solution that works well for Oregon and works well for our citizens. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, Representative Weininger. I know that the time is running late, but I have to say that that is an interesting idea that you've laid out. And from a separation of powers perspective, the accretion of power to the executive branch is pretty profound. You know, as this situation shows and what you describe shows, I think it would be interesting. I mean, I know that the APA exists at a federal level. I assume it exists at every state government level. So we didn't come up with the idea of having an APA or having agencies do this kind of decision making. It would be interesting when we have more time to think through whether other states have done the next step that you're proposing here, or if this would be a novel response to what feels like a muddying of the separation of powers. But thank you for bringing that forward.
Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair, I thank you. And I'd like to think that Oregon is still unique. And just as we initiated the initiative, the referendum, and the recall 100 years ago, we might be the state that shows the way about how you clean up the accretion of power under the Administrative Procedures Act and come up with a revised approach. And we did it partially with the Magistrate Division of Tax Court. And at that time, by the way, we did have testimony about the unfairness of the process, and I'll give you one sample. Three hearings officers for the Department of Revenue testified, and they were asked to testify under oath so that they were protected. And they were asked what the process was when they were adjudicating revenue issues between citizens and the Department of Revenue. And the testimony was, if you're going to issue a decision in favor of the taxpayer versus a decision in favor of the agency, what do you do? Well, if it's in favor of the agency, I'll just issue the decision. But our internal practice is if I'm going to issue a decision in favor of the citizen, I need to sit down in front of two other revenue hearings officers and hash it out to see whether or not I'm doing the right thing. Thumb on the scale of justice.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very much. Close the hearing on House Bill 4118. And I'm going to reopen House Bill 4128 for the purpose of allowing Representative Springer to vote. Representative Springer, how do you vote on 4128?
Aye.
Representative, if you don't, Representative Zoll. Any further business?
4087. We need a public hearing on 4087?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right.
Open the public hearing on House Bill 4087.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 4087 comes to you from Representative Peluso. The underlying bill prohibits employment disciplinary action against an officer solely for the reason the officer is on an impeachment list. This measure does not prohibit disciplinary action based on the underlying conduct that resulted in the officer being on that list. But the reason we're here today is to talk about the proposed Dash 1 amendments. These come from our House Judiciary Chair. It would allow law enforcement to file a petition in circuit court on behalf of a police officer to require withholding of the officer's personal information from disclosure in cases where, by clear and convincing evidence, the officer can demonstrate a credible threat of danger to the life of the police officer or immediate family of the officer. It specifies what information would be withheld and requires an in-camera review of the petition. It requires courts to enter an order granting or denying the petition within 5 business days of filing the petition. Committee, I will let you know that we are further refining these amendments, so you can expect to see a new version of this in the coming days.
Thank you. Rich Evans, Eric, and Michael Savaggio, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker. For the record, my name is Rich Evans, and I'm the superintendent of the Oregon State Police. The reason I'm here today is I spent the last month of my life in Burns, Oregon, and I'm going to highlight some of the facts that happened in the Burns area so that you have an understanding of why law enforcement is concerned and has brought this issue forward. On November 5th, 2015, Sheriff Ward met with two folks from a militia group. Well, the demand of Sheriff Ward was to that the Hammonds would not spend another day in jail. And if he did not meet those conditions that day, from that day forward, he was told there'd be civil unrest in his county. Immediately beginning after that meeting, officers, their families, and citizens who spoke out against the militia groups were being targeted. We have officers, troopers that were followed from their home to their residence. There were deputies followed from their home until their residence, and folks parking outside their house 11, 12, 1 o'clock at night, just parked out in front of their residence. The chief of Hines Police Department had his children followed from school and back several times by people in vehicles just following behind the children. The officers in the county, city, county, and state troopers evacuated their families. Their residents were identified, and they were in fear, just out of retaliatory nature. Sheriff Ward actually was shopping with his small son in Big Five for Christmas, where he was followed around the store for about 45 minutes by folks who were displaying firearms and following him around in an attempt to intimidate him. So these issues probably haven't hit the media yet. A local pastor actually put up an anti-bullying agenda on Facebook, and later on that night he had folks in his driveway parked outside of his residence and then began to follow around. Sheriff Ward actually introduced his parents in a meeting, a community meeting. Shortly after that, they had folks parked out in front of their residence and watching the elder, Mr. Ward, get his mail. We had a trooper that made an arrest of a DUI suspect, and we released that on YouTube. I think you probably, some of you have seen that. It was a 10 o'clock morning DUI arrest. The person had drove from the valley to Burns. He was armed with a pellet gun, highly intoxicated, and was stopped by several troopers. He was subsequently arrested for DUI, and the trooper was easily identified in that video. Later that weekend, while that trooper was still on assignment in Burns, his outside of his house was spray painted with "the trooper lives here. This is where the trooper is," and basically identifying his home 100 miles from where this occurred. And the only identifying issue was him arresting a drunk driver that was supposedly going to be Mr. Bundy's bodyguard. The families in Burns of my troopers are considering relocating. They're not sure they want to live there any longer due to their harassment. Everyone knows that they know where they're at. I talked to Sheriff Ward this morning, and he told me that he just got a call from a rancher that spoke out against the militia in a community meeting. Once he spoke out at the meeting, later that night, several vehicles pulled into his driveway and discharged firearms near his residence in the middle of the night. He didn't want to report that during the time because he was afraid of retaliation. The community of Burns, the law enforcement folks, and the Forest Service and BLM employees were in fear of retaliation or kidnapping or other things. The reason that I bring this forward to you is I know that since we've had some enforcement actions over there, as soon as we release the names, or if we have to release the names of the troopers involved in that, their families will be targeted. They will be targeted. We have received numerous threats by phone call and in the Joint Information Center, which is the information center in Burns, and at headquarters, and we have some of those recorded. We've received numerous accounts of those. This being a law enforcement officer today in these certain circumstances is kind of unnerving. I've arrested thousands of people in my 29 years of patrol. Every drunk driver that you arrest, you put them in handcuffs, they say they're going to kick your butt when the handcuffs are on. Everybody's done that. This is a different group. They're organized, they target individuals, and the fear of retaliation on families alone following children, identifying your wives, Sheriff Ward's wives' tires were slashed also, I forgot to mention that, targeting family members when no enforcement action is even taken, just that you are part of law enforcement. And so I hope that you support this bill. I don't believe it will be used very often, but I believe it's an extremely important tool to protect the men and women that protect us every day in the state of Oregon, whether that's a trooper, a deputy sheriff, and a city police officer. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Eric Ladd, and I'm a commander with the Marion County Sheriff's Office. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association and the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police in support of the Dash 1 Amendment to House Bill 4087. We fully support the petition authorized in this bill to address situations where a police officer or an immediate family member of the officer's family has received credible threat of danger to their life. The bill provides that a law enforcement unit can petition the court to require a law enforcement agency to withhold personal identification of an officer and the family member from disclosure. I did want to note one part of the amendment that seems to require an involved police officer to demonstrate the threat. We believe the law enforcement unit or agency should have that burden so the officer is not required to appear. This language appears on line 16 of the Dash 1 amendment. I'd also like to add, along with the superintendent, I had an opportunity to spend 2 weeks in Burns. I had personal conversations with troopers, deputies, the chiefs of police, and officers that work there about them moving their families out, about being followed in town, about having their houses driven by when they were at work. Their spouses would report that these guys were driving by their houses during different hours. We were able to put some limit to that, but it required that we put 8 two-person patrol shifts out, so that's 16 police officers on 12-hour shifts. And that was able. That's what it took in that small community to kind of hold that back a little bit. But clearly, it is still going on over there. So, thank you for the opportunity to testify, and we encourage the committee to adopt the Dash 1 amendment.
Thank you, Michael.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Michael Salvaggio for the Oregon Coalition of Police and Sheriffs. We represent line officers and sheriff's deputies around the state. We are the organization that brought to you the underlying bill, and we support the Dash 1 amendments. And I just want to quickly put on record that even though we're supporting the Dash 1 amendments, which are gut and stuff to the original bill, that should not be read as a rejection of our original bill. From our perspective, we hope that that conversation continues, but it will not continue this session. We're in strong support of the amendments. We believe that this protects officers or helps protect officers whose lives may be in danger as a result of simply doing their job. As was noted, it's triggered by a unit filing a petition with the circuit court, and we do believe that, yes, an officer must show that there's a credible threat. We believe that an officer, as the bill is written, can show that to their unit, and the unit may file that petition. Our law enforcement officers must be able to do their jobs every single day without having to worry that the execution of their job is not going to put their lives or their families' lives in jeopardy. That is really the only way that we're going to have a truly just law enforcement function in this state. And so we strongly, strongly support the Dash 1 amendments.
Okay, thank you. And it looks like this is really addressing the real serious, not a routine kind of police shooting or just somebody doing a little harassing. This is when there is an actual pretty much verifiable death threat that we want to protect that officer's name. And one of my family members was also up there. I was concerned about that for the pretty much the duration. She's finally humped back. But anyway, I understand this bill. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Superintendent, have there been requests for the officer involved in the shootings? Personal information, what is the context of those requests?
Chair Barker, Representative Springer, we have begun immediately from the media and the militia sources for that data and to release that data. Obviously, during the criminal investigation with the district attorney, that's going to depends on this bill, but it may end up being released. So that process has happened. It started. There's already been speculation of to who naming officers of who it could be, who it might be. And so those rumors are running rampant also.
Follow up?
Yeah.
But there's been specific requests for his information?
Yes.
And by whom?
Yes, there has been.
And any groups? Is it the militia or is it just people wanting to know?
What I don't want to do is say militia, identify certain militia, but yes, they are trying to figure out and ask who pulled the trigger.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you very much. Kimberly McCullough, please.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I'm Kimberly McCullough with the ACLU of Oregon. I'd like to start by just stating that we are very understanding and empathize with the officers that are going through this, and it's an extremely difficult and clearly a dangerous situation. So we appreciate that, and coming into this, we obviously have a very strong interest in transparency in government. So we're very appreciative that we've had the opportunity to work with the proponents on this to try to make sure that we find the right balance here. I'd like to just start by just mentioning a few of sort of what our guiding principles are when looking at this. And I just like to tell you at the start, as I go through this, that you can keep in mind that we are not opposing this bill as long as a few changes are made. And so there are some amendments in the works that address what our concerns are. We also very much appreciate that this bill is narrowly tailored to really only apply to very exceptional circumstances. And was clearly drafted with these considerations that I'm going to raise here in mind. So we appreciate that. The first thing, just, you know, the Oregon State Legislature has had a longstanding policy of in favor of disclosure of public records. So that's something we need to generally think about when we're thinking about things like this. In addition, law enforcement, because they have a quintessential public function, it really demands transparency in general. And it's also extremely important that we not send a message to the public that police officers are going to be shielded from public accountability in general. And we think about sort of high-profile shootings, and there are often fights over disclosure of names in those circumstances, and the public can become really upset if those names aren't released. And so in general, we do think that in the because of the need for transparency, because of the need for folks in the public to be able to see, you know, is this the same officer that was involved in some other use of force, or did they have a bad discipline history, things like that. Those are reasons that we generally want names disclosed. But at the same time, this situation is particularly unusual and quite different. There are cases that this has come up in a lot of times with the ACLU where we've actually pushed for disclosure of names, and the standard that the ACLU has pushed for in those cases actually matches essentially what's in this bill, which is that there needs to be an actual credible threat. So a lot of times in these cases, we see the departments are trying to keep the names from being disclosed, but there isn't a credible threat. And so what we've done in those circumstances is come in and said, no, the standard needs to be higher. It needs to be fairly exceptional. And what we've argued for in those cases that it needs to be a particularized showing of endangerment that outweighs the public interest in that regard. So I'll just take you through the few suggestions that we would like to see in the bill. One is that the bill doesn't specify a time period for how long the name is not disclosed. And we think that it's appropriate to have a time period so that a judge can then reevaluate the situation down the road and decide, is that threat still there? And when the threat is no longer there, then they can go ahead and disclose the name. Or if the threat remains, then they can extend again. And so that's something that we've asked for. Another thing is that we would like to link the withholding of the name to whatever incident it is that has caused the threat. So a situation like this, the way that this is going to come up is similar to what's happened, is there's a specific incident. Folks are making threats based on that particular incident, right? So if they go to court and they petition the court to say the name needs to be withheld, what we don't want is it just to be a blanket withholding of that officer's name in regards to any other thing, right? It needs to be a withholding of the officer's name in regards to that specific incident. So say they had some other thing that was completely unrelated, where maybe they had some misconduct or something like that, and there was a request for their name in that other circumstance, then withholding the name in this first circumstance shouldn't just automatically extend to these other circumstances, if that makes sense. The other situation that we want to address is if someone files civil litigation. So say, for example, the family of someone who's deceased, like in this situation, were to file a 1983 like civil rights suit or a wrongful death claim, it's extremely important in that litigation that they be able to find out who the officer is. And that's where this usually comes up, is in the context of litigation. And in that circumstance, the courts have a full body of case law that they consider when they decide whether or not to withhold a name, to seal it in the record, whether or not to release it under a protective order, or whether or not to release it to the public. And so we think at the point at which civil litigation starts, then the decision about whether or not to withhold the name or not should really be up to the judge in that case based on the case law that is already developed around this issue. So this would essentially allow the name to be withheld until the case happens, and then it's in that judge's hands. And then the other thing that was just a sort of technical thing is that the way that the amendment is written, it says that the officer's agency can file the petition, but then the burden of proof is on the officer themselves to prove that there's a threat. And it seems like it should be one or the other. It seems a little odd to say that the officer themselves can't file the petition, that it has to be their agency. So it could either be the officer does that, or the officer and the agency can do that, and whoever is filing the petition should then be the same party that has the burden of proof there. So that's just a little technical thing. But I think that actually covers everything that that we are concerned about. We do very much understand that this is a exceptional circumstance, and we think that with these additional amendments that it will be limited and narrow enough that it protects officers while at the same time leaving the general rule of disclosure in place.
Okay, thank you. And to point out again, this isn't to cover to take care of bad publicity. This is to take care of an actual threat. And I want to just say on the record too, the Representative Peluso had the other bill, which was the Brady bill, for lack of a better, longer term. And she generously gave that up so we could have this bill, because we were so late in the session already, so we were doing the gotten stuff on that. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Kimberly, you'd mentioned the need for an actual credible threat. That's included in the dash ones, right?
Correct.
So that's been met.
Yeah.
Right. Second, or another follow-up, Mr. Chair, thank you. So you mentioned, let me try to figure out how this would work, releasing the officer's name if they file a suit. So to get the officer's name, all you have to do is file a suit. And you're going to get the name, right? At what point is that name released? Talk to me a little bit about that. That didn't make sense.
Okay. Representative Springer and Chair Barker, to answer your question, my suggestion is that when the person files the lawsuit, so in a case like this where someone doesn't know who the defendant would be, they would file it as a, you know, versus John or Jane Doe. And then once that happens, then they move to try to get the court to get the defendants to release the name so that they can identify the defendant, and then they can do all their discovery and so on. So my suggestion is that once that lawsuit is filed and they file it against a John Doe, that then the judge in that case is the one who's then going to evaluate whether or not the name is released to the defendants, or whether or not it's released, or excuse me, not to the defendants, whether it's released to the plaintiff who filed that case, or whether it's released to them under a protective order, which would mean that the plaintiff could then not release it to the general public, but they'd at least know it for the purposes of their case. So there would be no automatic disclosure just because you file a lawsuit. It's just you file a lawsuit, now it's in the jurisdiction of that particular court and that particular judge, and they're going to make a decision based on the case law that surrounds when folks' names are disclosed when they're a party to a lawsuit, because there's a whole bunch of law already developed on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Follow up?
Oh, follow up.
So, and when you started your testimony, you mentioned that a lot of our current law is about accountability, and this is about accountability. I agree with that, quite frankly. However, this instance has nothing to do with accountability of that officer. The officer's still held accountable. Every officer's still held accountable in a separate system. We don't have to have his name released to people making threats to maintain accountability there. I know you said you weren't opposing the bill. Are you supporting the bill? Are you neutral on the bill? I know that you said you have some amendments you want, but I just want to be clear.
Right. So Representative Springer and Chair Barker, with the amendments, we would be neutral. That's the best you're going to get from the ACLU on a bill that says we're not disclosing something to the public.
Thank you.
Yeah. Representative Krieger.
Kimberly, you got four police officers up here, well over 100 years, I think. Now. Every one of us, I know, have supported the ACLU on some bills in the past because you were right. Mm-hmm. That's simple. You were right, so we supported you. And we kind of laugh and chuck, you know, always talk to the lobbyists, kind of kidded them. Mm-hmm. But we're living in a little bit different world today. Mm-hmm. Random shootings of police officers, not only police officers, but firefighters and first responders when they respond, mm-hmm. is taking place. It's mm-hmm. a different world. Mm-hmm. I'm very concerned where you're going, that you're going to go too far or want to go too far with the amendments. When you release the name of the officer, that's if he was just a lone person out there, mm-hmm. but 10 to 1, he or she is going to have a husband or wife and kids, and you're putting them in jeopardy. Mm-hmm. I don't know if the so-called society's right to know outweighs the safety issues around families.
Representative Krieger and Chair Barker, I appreciate what you're saying, and because of that, I've had conversations with the law enforcement folks that are involved in this and have talked to them about what our requests are for this amendment, and thus far I haven't received any negative feedback as far as what we're asking for being unreasonable. I think all we're looking for is that this be a narrow exceptional circumstance, and that there be proper court oversight, and that oversight have some, you know, that there be some limit to the time with which the name is withheld, so that it's withheld when there is a threat, and if there isn't a threat, then it's not withheld. And I'd also just like to say that, you know, part of our guiding principles that we come to this type of an issue with is that when terrible things happen in our society, we often want to jump very quickly to action while we're reacting. And we need to be really careful in those circumstances that we make good policy decisions and that those policy decisions don't have negative implications that we didn't anticipate because we were just thinking about the narrow scope of the terrible situation that we're facing. So I appreciate your concern about us going too far, and I think that's why my hope is that the collaboration on both sides of this gets us to the right place in the middle.
Okay. Representative Burton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, briefly, because I know the hour is late. You know, I have, through the years, tormented poor Kimberly and her predecessors, and on behalf of the ACLU. This is one time when I want to respectfully suggest that some of the things that I'd like to see it in black and white, but as described verbally, sounded like very reasonable signboards on something that's really important. I completely understand how important it is, but the thing about these public records exemptions is that there's no sunset to them. They stay there forever and ever and ever. And although we can all agree we're dealing with a unique situation now, and I'm sure it would be applied fairly right now, I'm thinking about what would it look like in 50 years. And there is, in this country, for example, of the, remember how she was talking earlier about the federal court procedure with the John and Jane Does and then the subject to protective order? And that body of case law that I don't even know we could change, actually, was developed, for example, in response to some civil rights abuses when state law enforcement officers in the 60s were thwarting federal civil rights laws, things like that. So, again, this is a unique situation now. I completely support doing something about it, protect the officers. I'd love to see this in writing because what I think you're describing, I think once I actually read it, will sound quite palatable, and I really appreciate the LCU engaging with us to try and make a better law.
Thank you.
When this issue first came up, I immediately sent an email to Kimberly McCullough and said, we have this thing coming up I need to see right away. So
great.
Because I knew that they would have some good input on that. So
appreciate that, Mr. Chair.
And times have changed. They are bad right now, but I remember back in the 60s when it was the rich Ivy League kids who were trying to start the revolution for different reasons. And they were really killing a lot of police and doing a lot of hundreds of bombings in this country, which dates me by saying that. But I remember those pretty clearly, and the threats when I was a new young policeman. Anyway, with no further ado, we'll carry over for work session House Bill 4066 and 4087. Thank you. Thank you.